This is the rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Coming up on the show, 120 years ago, the University of Florida moved from Lake City to Gainesville. We take a look back in time to what it was like at the turn of the century. And later, part two of a two-part series on higher education accreditation. This time, the implications of Florida forming its own accrediting body. But first, Florida is setting a record pace for executions. Last year, the state accounted for 40% of all executions in the country. And so far this year, Florida has put more men to death than all other states combined. But the systems we have in place to keep innocent people off of death row don't always work as intended. At least that's the finding of Pamela Koloff. She's a reporter at ProPublica and a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. She recently wrote a book titled Catch the Devil about a jailhouse informant whose testimony put a man on death row where he sits to this day. I spoke with her earlier and asked her about her findings.
I had discovered over the years that if a case had a jailhouse informant in it, something was wrong with the case. That's the simplest way I can put it. It was a giant red flag. When the National Registry of Exonerations looked at how many cases jailhouse informants and their testimony had played a role in, 7% of people who were wrongly convicted had been wrongly convicted with the help of a jailhouse informant. When they looked at death penalty cases, that number went up to 25%. One out of four people who've been exonerated after sitting on death row landed there because of the testimony of a jailhouse informant. So what does that mean? A jailhouse informant is someone who is usually awaiting trial, who's jailed with other people who are awaiting trial, and who offers testimony to investigators and prosecutors in the hope of gaining leniency. So in the case of Paul Skalnick, who's the man at the center of my book, he figured out this get out of jail free trick, which was he knew that he could go to police and prosecutors and say, hey, that guy in the cell next to me, he told me he did it, and they would put him on the stand. They would use his very colorful and incendiary storytelling to secure the most punishing sentences that they could, including death sentences. And then Paul Skalnick would usually walk free in return.
And the stories in this book feel especially prescient right now, with Florida setting a record pace of executions both last year and this year, including literally this week we had two men executed in the same day for the first time in over 60 years. So why does it feel like Florida is moving in seemingly the opposite direction as a lot of the rest of the country in terms of their stance on capital punishment?
This issue, it's so interesting. I mean, the case at the heart of my book happened in 1985, and yet these issues couldn't be more relevant today. You know, we are in the epicenter of what's happening in capital punishment in the United States. And it comes at this time, as you said, that so many states are moving away from the death penalty. And Florida has a setup sort of unlike any other in that among active death penalty states right now, there is one person who decides who is executed next and when, and that is the governor. And so we don't have a lot of transparency about why people are being executed in Florida, you know, roughly every 30 days, which is just a remarkable rate. I wrote about the tremendous strain that that puts on corrections officers, on clergy, on families of both the victims and of the condemned. We can only hope that the governor's office clarifies what is motivating this. And all that Governor DeSantis has said so far is that he is trying to bring resolution and justice to victims' families.
If there is one thing you want people to take away from your book and from your reporting, what is that message?
So I think that we are all susceptible to someone like Paul Skalnick. begin my book talking about going to see him in 2018 in federal prison, and how he, though he told me all sorts of outrageous things that I knew were lies, like he told me about his 100-foot yacht in Belize and his offshore bank accounts. He also could sense what I was hungry for. I wanted him to talk to me for my story, and he strung me along for months, making me think that he was going to cooperate with the story. And then, of course, he didn't. But I think, you know, we all have that human need to believe the stories that we want to believe. When that intersects with the incentives that we have in the criminal justice system, incentives like, you know, prosecutors are supposed to do justice, but really the pressures that are on them are to win convictions. You know, for an investigator, the difference between pounding the pavement for 2 months and tracking down every witness and trying to figure out what happened in a case, rather than just going over to the jail and saying, hey, you know, who can help me with this case? I think we have to be at all times aware of the fact that when we are too hungry for a conviction in a case or an easy answer, that we may rely upon dishonest brokers like Paul Skelnick, and that can lead to wrongful convictions and does lead to wrongful convictions.
Pamela Koloff, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Koloff will be in Gainesville for an author event at the Lynx Bookstore tonight at 6 p.m. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Florida has a lot of stories to tell. Do you know your community's history? It's time for a trivia question. Which charming Florida town is sometimes called the town that time forgot? Stay tuned to the end of the show for the answer. It was 120 years ago this month that the University of Florida moved from Lake City to Gainesville, and the decision to settle here had a rocky start. WUFT's Stryker Anderson looked into it.
It's hard to find someone who was around in 1906 who remembers UF moving, but there is one account.
I haven't been on the campus of the university since the dedication of Sled Hall, and you will have to look up the date.
This is the voice of Frances Sled Blake. We found her account in UF's archives. She was the daughter of the university's first president, Andrew Sled. Now, this is from a 1974 interview conducted at a nearby restaurant, so you'll have to listen carefully to understand her.
There were three small state schools which were to be amalgamated to make the University of Florida. One was at Tallahassee, one was at Lake City, and I think the other one was in Ocala.
This was because Florida passed the Buckman Act. The 1905 legislation restructured the state university system and consolidated colleges throughout the state into three distinct universities. One of those was UF. Before the move, the Lake City campus was designated as the state's flagship institution, and any discussion of changing towns was controversial. But Gainesville was persistent and offered incentives, things like affordable land, public school buildings, and free access to fresh water. That's according to a 1905 article in the Gainesville Sun. Here's more from the article.
Several prominent citizens of Lake City were present and presented their claims in a forceful and impressive manner, but evidently with insufficient force to convert the requirement of the board.
Lake City didn't like the idea of the move at all. Once again, Frances Sled Blake.
They did not like the losing of actually the money that came in from the students and from the college. They didn't want to lose the business.
After hearing both proposals, the State Board of Education decided to make Gainesville UF's new home. Gainesville was so happy about it, they even took out a column in the paper.
A sacred trust has fallen to our city, and in all the varied changes in the coming years, we will ever hold next to him on high. Our duty to these institutions, where the minds of our youth are to be molded for the perpetuity of our state and the nation.
And if residents in Lake City didn't like the idea of the move, they were even angrier on moving day.
They threatened father with tying and feathering him if they could catch him. And, of course, that was a dare which he accepted.
Despite the threats, UF moved from Lake City on July 23, 1906. Everything from books to furniture was packed onto wagons and taken to the new location in Gainesville. With threats of violence looming, some university employees felt they needed to take extra precautions.
Another incident in that connection was that they said they would shoot the first man who drove a dray.
Incidentally, a dray is a wagon.
A dray to the depot carrying any of the their equipment to be moved again.
UF officials say one professor even rode with a loaded rifle on his lap on the drive from Lake City to Gainesville. But there were no problems. The move took place without incident, and school commenced on September 26, 1906. Stryker Anderson, WUFT News.
This is the Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Coming up later in the show, higher education accreditation could look very different in Florida in the future. Part two of a two-part series, we'll dig into how. That's after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. A group of southern states has come together to form a new accrediting body for public colleges and universities. Because accreditation is tied to access to federal student aid, the move could have major implications for higher education across the region. Last week, WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero explained how the Commission for Public Higher Education came together and why Florida helped lead the effort. Today, WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri looks at how educators working in these states view joining the commission and what it could mean for teaching, learning, and academic freedom.
The Commission for Public Education, CPHE for short, could begin operating as soon as next year. Its guiding standards were adopted late last year, but educators remain divided over the standards. The flashpoints are academic freedom and intellectual diversity, the bedrock of higher education. In a section about intellectual diversity, the new guidelines say that favoring certain ideas on campus is valid when campus culture is skewed towards other ideas. In effect, schools can tilt the scales in the name of achieving a balance. That balance will be considered when it comes to access to federal money.
It leaves a lot of leverage for the state to basically say, you don't have enough of the ideas that I like, therefore we're going to call this institution not intellectually diverse. And if you don't do something about it, then we'll pull your accreditation.
Isaac Kamola is director of the Center for the Defense of Academic Freedom at the American Association of University Professors, a professional organization. He's also an associate professor of political science at Trinity College in Connecticut.
Politicians and political movements, MAGA, has basically decided we don't like the ideas that are being produced within the university. And instead of refuting them on scholarly grounds, right, we're going to put our thumb on the political scale in order to prevent those ideas from being taught.
For decades, most Southern universities and colleges have been accredited through the Southern Association of Colleges, the region's long-term accrediting body. SACS has a history of setting hard boundaries between politicians and state schools, including recently between Governor Ron DeSantis and the University of Florida. In the era of the so-called culture war waged on college campuses, fields like sociology have been targeted. Officials in Florida and Texas recently removed intro to sociology classes from the core curriculum, a field of study that closely examines how the treatment of men and women varies, or being black or white. Ray Rodriguez is the chancellor of the State University System of Florida. He was one of the officials leading the effort to get introduction to sociology removed. He said this in March ahead of the vote to do that.
Sociology is a discipline. It is now social and political advocacy dressed in the regalia of the academy.
The CPHE did incorporate academic freedom and a stance that it's up to faculty to determine curriculum.
I know that the fact that the commission adopted an intellectual diversity standard surprised some people.
Cameron Howell is a University of South Carolina administrator and senior advisor to the board of directors for the CPHE. He says the concerns are misplaced.
We'd like to think that we've devised an approach to intellectual diversity narrowly, appropriately, in a way that doesn't undermine the academic freedom that belongs to institutions or to faculty.
Rob Tabor is an associate professor of history at Fayetteville State University in North Carolina. When he and colleagues found out about a new potential accreditor, they knew they wanted to be involved. Tabor's now been leading a faculty group that has advised the commission over the last year.
We want to make sure that this is actually supporting university excellence, insisting that a geology class incorporate flat earth viewpoints, for example, would be a disservice to the students.
Tabor wants his students to think critically, be analytical, and engage in robust dialogue.
The affiliation with an accreditor is supposed to be voluntary. I'm a historian of slavery in Latin America. If for some reason CPHE turns into an accreditation agency that would prevent my teaching, my research, or otherwise impact or harm academic freedom, free inquiry, harm the student experience, my advice to my provost and senior leadership would be, let's not go with CPHE.
Jackie Ignatova is co-president of the AAUP local chapter and faculty at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. She teaches sustainable development and remains skeptical.
There's rising student concern about what all of this means for their ability to learn on subjects like climate change, gender, inequality, you know, racism in healthcare, things like that.
Instead of librarians at each school making the call on what books to keep, the commission could take control of that for the whole university system in a state.
For me, that creates, I think, an opportunity for more efficient censorship should it be used by a bad actor.
Ignatova says this could present an ethical and moral conflict for professors. Down the line, they may consider a difficult choice: teach the subject according to their expert standards and knowledge, or water it down to the version state officials want.
I know what I was trained and hired to teach, and I'm going to continue to teach it. That is my choice, and I know that there could be consequences for that. But I also know that these attacks on higher ed are fascism in practice, and I don't like playing nice with fascists.
For Howell of the CPHE, the creation of the commission isn't about favoring one political agenda over another. It's about adding options, diversity, to the marketplace of accrediting bodies.
We hope that we'll enable the Commission for Public Higher Education to be around for 100 years and withstand different presidential administrations, different executives who might be in charge of the U.S. Department of Education. We want to devise something that is smart and not driven by politics or ideology.
Governor DeSantis, one of the effort's strongest leaders, has argued the effort should move forward while the Trump administration is still in office. I'm Natalie LaRoche-Pietri in Miami.
If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. As a reminder, our trivia question this week: what charming Florida town is sometimes called the town that time forgot? The answer's coming up at the end of the show. That's after a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Okay, everyone's talking about it. The new Christopher Nolan film, The Odyssey. The film is widely known because of the marketing budget. That alone cost $125 million. But what people aren't talking about? The youth-staged play at the High Springs Playhouse. Their performance of Robin Hood is totally run by kids aged 10 to 17. It's a lot of responsibility for the first-time director, 16-year-old Clara Foltz.
I had to design the costume and the set and the lighting, the sound, like pretty much every technical aspect. And then running rehearsals, I'm responsible for the blocking, helping the kids with their character work, and like really just at a typical rehearsal. It's just like running the scene over and over.
The play itself, it has the classic characters like Robin Hood, Little John, Friar Tuck, the Sheriff. But the director tells us it mainly focuses on the origin story of Robin Hood, played by 12-year-old Archer Newton.
I've always watched a movie and be like, it would be so cool if I acted in a movie and it was released. And it would be even better if it was a big hit.
And why acting? Why not basketball or video games?
Doing sports every day for a whole season and playing video games every day for a whole year can get pretty boring. So I wanted to change things up.
One of the things that everyone seems to like is the fight scenes.
Our fight choreographer, Ted Lewis, who helped found the Thieves Guild in Gainesville, he helped choreograph our show. And so the fights are like really impressive. And the audience is always like cheering, get him. Yeah. And they're really into it.
The play even includes the classic case of breaking the fourth wall, where Friar Tuck interacts with and even rewards the audience.
There are some points where he will, like, take the money Robin Hood has stolen and redistribute it to the poor, and the poor being the audience, so he throws, like, chocolate coins into the audience.
But 12-year-old Robin Hood did confess one thing to us about his part in all of this.
I wanted to be a villain. I didn't even want to be a hero. And so I was like, ooh, it would be really cool if I was, like, the sidekick of a villain. I'd be like, heck yeah. And so I tried to get Lord Dunstan's role, but, yeah. And I got Robin Hood. It's really, it caught me off guard, that's for sure.
Even so, Archer Newton is quick to add that even though the play is called Robin Hood, it's not just about him.
It's Maid Marian, it's Little John, it's every single good person out there that's trying to right the wrong in this play.
The summer youth production of Robin Hood runs tonight through Sunday at the High Springs Playhouse. You can see the kids rehearse one of those fight scenes on our website, WUFT.org. The Rundown is a production of WUFT News out of the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. The team that made the show possible this week includes Dave Bereswain, Ailey Shanes, Stryker Anderson, Natalie LaRoche-Pietri, and Tess Lippincott. Our trivia question this week, which charming Florida town is sometimes called the town that time forgot? The answer? Micanopy. That's it for The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina.